Welcome to the Late Set from WRTI. I'm Josh Jackson.
I'm Nate Chenin.
Happy New Year.
Happy New Year. We can still say that, whatever Larry David has to say. You know, I claim the all January Happy New Year exemption.
Yes.
How about
that? As opposed to the dry January. I'm not for that at all.
Yeah, forget that. But we, you know, in addition to turning the page on the calendar, we are in 2026, which happens to be a momentous year for America, for the observation of this nation's establishment, and for some reflection on what it is that makes the USA what it is.
Freedom!
And we are not untroubled in this reflection as we move through the early part of 2026. It's been kind of a rough entry here.
It's an unusual start to this. What is it called? Demi sesqui? I can't remember.
You know, every time I say that word, it goes into my brain and it just takes the nearest exit.
Gotcha.
I'm not going to hold on to it.
250. Yeah, what a great way to start.
You know, it's interesting to think about that commemoration. I don't think we were born in the same year, but I am a bicentennial baby. I was born in 1976.
Oh, you're just rubbing it in, you're younger.
The observation of our nation's founding is, you know, it's also part of my origin story. But as I think about, you know, that moment of reflection and looking back to the founding documents and our guiding principles and, you know, I don't think we need to get into specifics, but all of it is being contested at the moment. And there's been some interesting examples of jazz artists, you know, kind of stepping up, not even through words, but through deeds. And I'm thinking in particular about a couple of news stories that came over right around the holidays. The New Year's Eve concert scheduled by, you know, longstanding concert at the Kennedy Center that vibraphonist Chuck Redd, or I guess it was a holiday concert for him, and a New Year's Eve concert by the Cookers. And in both cases, these artists said, you know, this doesn't feel right. We're not going to do this. It earned a lot of attention, positive and negative. It earned some threats of legal action. But I think it's interesting that jazz was and is in that conversation quite prominently. And I don't know, I wonder what you think about this weird moment when we are celebrating this nation, but also kind of feel queasy about the whole thing. Where do you situate these actions and this moment, you know, compared to the things that we like to talk about in the past, where jazz musicians stepped up and spoke truth to power?
I really only have this to say, and that is art can't be contained, Nate.
Mm-hmm.
It can't be constrained by a building, no matter what you call it. And it can't be constrained by people who want you to do a certain thing. It doesn't mean it has to be done. The music is free. And that's really as far as I take it. I don't even have a strong opinion as it relates to whether or not it's the duty of an artist to protest anything.
Right.
I'm not saying that it isn't okay if any artist does this, but I don't know that it's necessary for it to be valued as art. This is probably not where you want to take this conversation.
I mean,
so
I'm interested in having the conversation, you know,
yeah.
Because I think it is interesting to think about, like, what does a principled stand look like in this moment? Mm-hmm. What does resistance look like in this moment?
Okay.
You know?
Yeah.
And I do think in everything that I've seen, I've followed the Cookers story a little more than I followed the other one.
Yeah.
Right. But, you know, I have respect for, you know, the artists who say, well, we're not okay with rolling into this space and
totally.
And, you know,
that's anybody's
falling in line, right?
That's anybody's prerogative.
Yeah.
You know, this is business. You mm-hmm. know, there's a contract generally
right.
between an organization, a presenter, and a performer. And, you know, like when you get down to it, we're talking about contracts here.
But it's interesting to think about where is the breach of contract if the entity that you committed to has been fundamentally altered?
That's a great question. Yeah. I mean, and that could even be the argument for not having to assume any liability for canceling one's own gig at a particular venue. I mean, it could be one argument, and I'm not a lawyer either, that, well, this isn't the venue that I signed up for.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I mean, there's a lot of things that, you know, that will continue to churn this kind of consternation among Americans.
Right. Our guest this episode is Dave Douglas, a trumpeter, composer, label owner, festival organizer, educator. I mean, he's many things. And one thing that I have always known him to be is quite outspoken about, you know, principles and, you know, really what he believes. There's an interesting moment in this conversation where I sort of asked him about a little more reserve that he has now than he did at another time. And he very readily acknowledged, like, you know, something has changed. I felt like there was a time when I could say my piece. And even if you disagreed with it, there was a kind of, there was a possibility of dialogue.
Yeah.
And he feels like that door has effectively been shut, which is really unfortunate. But it is, I think, an accurate reading. And so he has instead, you know, taken those ideals and you know, he hasn't walked away from them in any way, but he's really channeled it into the art making and into the music. And so this album is called Four Freedoms, and it's inspired by a bit of political statecraft that we talk about in the interview. But it has a lot of, bears a lot of relevance to this moment when we're thinking about America and what, you know, why it is and what it is.
I'm excited to find out myself.
All right. Well, this is my conversation with Dave Douglas. He is in his home studio, a beautiful light-filled space
on
the Hudson River.
Yeah.
And I am here in North Philadelphia at WRTI. Here we go. Dave Douglas, thank you for joining us on the Late Set.
Hi, Nate. Thanks for having me. So nice.
People who are listening cannot see what I see, but it looks like a very beautifully cozy music studio in the Hudson Valley. Oh. I see a little snow outside, see some music on your piano, a very conducive space to music making and thinking.
I've been writing a lot and, you know, practicing, of course. But yeah, it's a nice place to work. I can't complain. Now, people are used to listening to you and they can't see you either. And you're in a very beautiful, scientifically clean space. It's like a laboratory environment.
It is.
Which is, it is also must be pretty focusing.
Function first in these institutional settings. But
I think jazz and music and the arts, you know, that you get to present it and come from that place.
My office is a little prettier than this recording booth. But I'm so happy to be connecting with you for a number of reasons, but the one that really brings us here is this new album. I guess it's out now at the time that we put this out. This is the new release on your label, Greenleaf Music, and features a really wonderful quartet and also grapples with or engages with a very important and provocative idea. And so we're going to talk about all of that today. But I guess I'd like to start at the beginning and ask you, what came first? Was it the concept and inspiration, or was it the personnel?
Wow. Quite honestly, it's really hard to say. Just because music is so mysterious, it's hard to go back after the fact and say, well, what happened first? I've been meeting these musicians over a number of years. In the case of Joey Barron, I've been playing with him, geez, since 1990 was the first time I played with him. So
that's, more than 35. What's
that, 4 years? Yeah. No, 35 years. I met Nick Dunstan, the bass player, maybe a decade ago as a student at the New School.
As we speak, I just saw him last night.
Oh, great.
With Chess Smith's band here in Philly.
What a great player. I mean, he was already a great player. People, musicians have a personality right away, I think, whether they know it or not. So there was always something about Nick that was very energetic and captivating and sort of explosive. And he's only deepened that since that time. And the funny thing is, you probably know he moved to Berlin a few years ago after getting out of music school. Good for him. He moved to Berlin and I kind of thought, oh, well, okay, wow, all right, too bad, we lost one. And then as I started touring more in Europe and Joey Barron moved to Europe, he was also living in Berlin, I was like, oh, this kind of makes sense. Then about 7 or 8 years ago, I started playing with the pianist Marta Varelis, who's Polish, living in the Netherlands. Mm-hmm. And I mean, as you can hear on this recording, a really special and sensitive and energetic player. And so that's how this band came together, was from me touring in Europe and working with musicians living in Europe. And it sort of became a working band. I think that I've lost track of what your question was, but I feel like somehow tangentially I must be answering it.
It is appropriate then, as we talk about the idea and the concept and the personnel, that it is kind of inextricable because, as you say, this is your sort of, this is like your NATO band. It's like Americans in Europe and
I would
Europeans
say, now that
working.
You reminded me of the question, I think there was a concept forming in me that was also being formed by meeting this group of players.
Okay.
So I don't think you can separate the two. And the album is called Four Freedoms, and there's something about the kind of freedom that this band plays with and that this band suggested to me as a composer that went into what the theme of the album and the theme of the writing became.
Yeah. Now, for those who are not instantly familiar with the Four Freedoms, let's get into the background a bit. When Franklin Roosevelt, in his third term as president, gave the State of the Union on January 6th of 1941.
January 6th.
Yes. There's all kinds of weird January 6th resonances throughout history, but that's another story for another time. But this speech was, of course, to Congress. And he came with a sort of mandate of persuasion. And I reread the entire speech this morning, and I was so struck by how carefully and confidently and cajolingly he makes the case. Mm-hmm. And what he is seeking is effectively authorization to provide military materials, assistance to allies in Europe who are standing against invasion, tyranny, conquering forces. Again, it's 1941. This speech has become known as the Four Freedoms because of a section that he added at the very end of the speech, which is known as the peroration. But the entire speech is really interesting because of what it stands for, what it means. So I've been lecturing here, but I'd love to hear
what this means to you. I mean, Nate, I think he's basically talking about basic decency for all humans. Mm-hmm. And that's his way of spelling it out. And the histories that I've read said that Eleanor Roosevelt had a lot to do with him formulating that statement at that time in those terms. I feel
can we outline the four? What are the four freedoms?
Oh,
as he articulates them?
You're gonna trip me
okay,
up.
Okay, I have
you're
it in front of me.
You're the peroration here.
So I'll actually read how he articulated them, because he was pretty succinct on these points. You know, he says, in the future days, which we seek to make secure, we look forward to a world founded upon four essential human freedoms. Mm-hmm. The first is freedom of speech and expression everywhere in the world. The second is freedom of every person to worship God in his own way everywhere in the world. The third is freedom from want, which translated into world terms means economic understandings, which will secure to every nation a healthy peacetime life for its inhabitants everywhere in the world. And the fourth is freedom from fear, which translated into world terms means a worldwide reduction of armaments to such a point and in such a thorough fashion that no nation will be in a position to commit an act of physical aggression against any neighbor anywhere in the world.
Now, that's aspirational.
Heavy. It's
definitely
aspirational.
This is coming from the United States of America, mind you, not right. exactly a perfect track record here. So he was still willing to spell that out and at the same time intern Japanese Americans during the Second World War, among so many other things that our country's done. So I don't know. I don't want to get into it on that level because I feel like we get way off track from talking about the music. That is an incredibly inspirational and a vision worth standing up for and a vision worth remembering right now with everything that's going on in our streets. At the same time, for me as a practicing musician, it also points towards a freedom of expression as far as the arts are concerned and as far as our own personal practice as improvisers, composers, and a community of musicians. It goes into the music itself, the mentality that it takes to play in a band and to play with other human beings. That's the freedom in this music that I'm talking about that I find hard to separate from FDR. And this speech about the four freedoms, the four human freedoms. Freedom from want, freedom from fear. Wow.
Yeah. And it's interesting, you know, so you mentioned what's happening in our streets and things may even be different between the time we're speaking now and the time this podcast drops.
They surely will. And it's happening
it has already
so fast.
Been, yeah. It has already, we've already lived 10 years in 2026, right? In terms of psychic toll. But I think that whenever it was that you decided to embrace this concept and release this album in 2026, you were aware of the fact that 2026 is the 250th anniversary of the signing of the Declaration of Independence. The first two of these four freedoms are foundational to this nation's understanding of itself, right? Freedom of speech and freedom of religion. It goes all the way back. And I think that freedom of want and freedom of fear, that was a very FDR addition there. And you're right to point to the sort of ironical side of that. You know, the fact that freedom from fear, as he defines it, is a freedom from armaments. And meanwhile, the purpose of this speech is to ask Congress to approve the budgeting and the commitment to a war effort.
To join the Second World War on behalf of Britain and France and
initially
the
through the production of
armaments.
Machines of war, armaments, materials, and you can trace the steps that then lead to Pearl Harbor and our entry into that war actively. But it's complicated, right? I think that we can take at his word the idea that this is about defending freedom, right? This statement.
It's also an aspiration. It's something to work towards every day. And I think that's where it really intersects with being an improviser, being someone who plays music with other musicians somewhere between composition and improvisation and notation and non-gestural spirit-driven activities.
Thank you. The title track of the album, Four Freedoms, feels like a very direct engagement of those ideas. It is the most freeform seeming piece on this album. It's very open. It breathes. It doesn't have a discernible form. I'm sure that there are some guidelines that you've created there, but it feels like a musical illustration of what you just described, this idea of finding it together and trusting one another. What can you say about that?
There's certainly a lot of finding it and trusting each other, but I would also say that for all the music that I wrote, including that piece, Four Freedoms, I was looking for new ways for us to interact, new ways mm-hmm. for us to find that freedom. And I think as a band leader over many years now, I find that the answer more often than not comes from the players, mm-hmm. just from a very mindful observation of people's instincts and what they do and how they react and how they play. So I wouldn't be able to separate that writing from the inspiration of the players themselves. Mm-hmm. I was looking for a new way for this band to be able to play, to have freedom by a different set of rules and laws, in the same way that we're looking for a new set of rules and laws to make our own society make sense, you know, if you want to bring it back to FDR. But in the case of this piece, Four Freedoms, it's a graphic score, which means it's a drawn set of diagrams that are pretty specific, but they leave a lot of room for places to go, you know, suggestions for gestures and how players would play. Marta Varelis is really deep player inside the piano, what they call a prepared piano. And she's got all sorts of tools and tricks. And so I wrote this piece specifically for her to use that language. Mm. And then did some preparations on the trumpet too that you'll hear. So we're all reading the same score, but we're all reading it in our own way and coming to different conclusions. And there mm-hmm. is a very strict form that we're following, but it's not a form like Donna Lee, for example, or Now's the Time. And it's a different kind of structure and form. And I feel like, you know, that's the search with a band like this, is to say something new through the communal language that we use together.
And when you say graphic score, is there a consistent graphic vocabulary you have, you know, in the way that someone like Wadada Leo Smith or Anthony Braxton has, like, a, you know, a system? Or is it something that you devise kind of piece by piece for the moment at hand?
I think that I probably have my own language and process, but I haven't put as much thought into it as Wadada and Anthony and Henry
Threadgill. That's a high bar.
And yeah, the way that I use it tends to be, you know, more situational, getting myself into a place and having to work myself out of it by devising a system of drawing and shapes.
You've used the word aspirational a few times.
Yeah.
And there's another piece on this album titled Dreams We Hold, which seems to speak directly to something along the lines of aspiration.
A lot of the writing on this record, I was experimenting with writing individual parts for the players, but having them be free to move at different speeds and different paces, and to experiment with articulation. So instead of it being the trumpet and the piano and the bass are all moving consistently along left to right, each person has their own parts that can intersect, but they're free to intersect in different ways. So Dreams mm-hmm. We Hold is one where there's a lot of different moving parts, and so it sounds very fluid, but also the goal in some sense for me being getting each person's voice in there, getting, you know, somebody who's really more than anything involved in improvisation, involved in an activity of interpreting a composition.
That is one of my favorite pieces on the album. I think for that reason, because of that flexibility is very, it feels very natural and it's beautifully expressed.
Oh, thank you so much. That's nice. There's another piece that operates a little like that. It's called Militias.
Mm-hmm. I was going to mention that.
Yeah, yeah. Well, it that one, the visualization is more like a roving band of four separate independent teams moving. And so each phrase is written in such a way that it would be almost impossible to play it metrically together. And so by necessity, it's interpreted with a level of freedom that is sort of the only way to move through it. And then in the improvisation, each team goes off on its own. And then we find out where that leads to, not like a battle, but more like a moving across terrain.
So when you use the title Militias,
yeah,
you're not necessarily thinking about the contemporary political dimension of that word.
Well, I don't know. Everybody seems to use that word differently to their own, you know, whatever argument they're trying to make. So no, mm-hmm. to me, it's more about, you know, I'm an American, so there's always a certain amount of rugged American individualism involved. But I also mean more in the sense of loosely unregulated teams operating towards a goal.
With the use of that word, I sense from you a kind of pained ambivalence on the subject of how much to engage with the contemporary sort of topical reality, you know, the horrors that we face.
I just think it's a different kind of engagement.
Yeah. Okay. Because
I don't think it's an intellectual engagement. I think it's a engagement of feeling and sensibility and a mirroring of what's happening, a translation.
Yeah. I mean, at this moment, everyone, and not just artists, right? Everyone who is paying any amount of attention is struggling to make sense of current reality and then to figure out both inwardly and outwardly, what am I supposed to do?
Mm-hmm.
Inwardly in terms of like, how do I protect myself and my loved ones mentally, physically? Right. And then outwardly, like, what am I supposed to do? How can I help?
Or
how to engage? And clearly the answer will be different for every person, but it's a very vexing question to ask oneself.
It is. And the times have changed so much.
Yeah.
You remember 20 years ago how vehemently I spoke out against the Iraq War.
I do.
And I feel like the quality of the conversation was just different. That you could have a conversation with somebody who was on the quote-unquote other side of the issue. And at a certain point along the way, it felt like if I said anything from the stage, rather than opening the door to a dialogue, it closed the door because the sides got more dug in. And it's like, oh, I see you're over there. Okay, forget it.
Right, right.
I'm leaving.
Yeah, there's almost like an instant taxonomy where it's like, oh, okay, you're one of these. I'm putting
one
you
of
in
them,
this category.
Yeah, I've put you in this box, which happens in music all the time, sadly. I don't want to be in one of those boxes, and I don't believe that any of us really live in any of those boxes inside ourselves.
Yeah.
I did feel that the blogosphere and social media for a short time were an open forum where discussions about music and society and our leadership could take place. And I no longer feel that. And I don't know really what, I haven't figured out what that means, but I have found that funneling all that thought, it's funny. I think you interpret that as ambivalence because I've stopped talking about it, but it's all funneled into the music. Every project that I make, I feel now is a part of that statement.
Yeah.
About what we ought to be doing and how we ought to live together and what it means to live in a diverse society and be interested and curious about the people all around you.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I should be clear that when I said ambivalence, it had more to do with eagerness to engage than with an understanding of the importance of engaging, you know, and that you brought it around to the thing I was going to ask next, which was the idea of creating and cultivating a community.
Mm-hmm.
I think that you've done this extraordinarily well over the last 20, 25 years.
Still working on it. It's aspirational.
Sure. Yeah. But you do it on the bandstand and you also do it with your label and your business practices. And then, you know.
The Trumpet Festival, too, has been really important.
Absolutely.
In that
regard. And then, you know, Greenleaf also has a podcast where you engage in conversations with a wide range of artists. And, you know, and so it's in a certain way, maybe it's less about projecting outward to whoever is there to pick up the signal and more about like, well, let's create a space inside of which there's like understanding and potential to be challenged and lots of room for growth. So I don't know if you feel that way about sort of the shift in the model, but when I think about you as a kind of creative catalyst, like that's certainly one thing that comes to mind.
Bands have always been important to me, and it's the only reason I've ever composed, because I had friends who played real good, and I wanted to have some cool stuff to play with them.
Yeah.
And it's, at the root of it, that's still what it is, all of these different groups that I write for. Alloy came out this year, and to be able to work with two young trumpet players like Dave Adewumi and Alexandra Ridout, it was just such a high and a thrill to get to write for them and to open up a space where we all could play together. Four Freedoms is the same. And I think that, I don't know, I don't see it as a closed community because everyone in all of these groups also plays in a dozen other groups.
Right.
And almost everyone is also a band leader these days. So these are like ripples that flow outward in the pond. When I wrote the piece that's called My First Rodeo, I didn't have a title for it for the longest time. And then I was like practicing it one day and I was kind of like, you know, it's almost like got a country western vibe to it. And it was like rodeo. Yeah. And then there's the phrase, you know, this is not my first rodeo, someone who has a lot of experience will say. And I thought, well, you know, I'm not going to use an expletive. Let's throw out the experience. This is my first rodeo. That's what it's about. And then it's really funny because I put it in front of Nick and he just laughed immediately. I was like, okay, great.
Yeah.
We're all on the same page here.
There's one composition, a piece that bears a dedication to one of your bandmates. Mm-hmm. So those are Ruminants for Marta and Fire in the Firewood for Nick and Grits for Joey. And these are all, there may be sort of concerti in a kind of way, you know, dedications. When you compose a piece dedicated to a person, what is the thing that you are thinking about? Are you trying to capture a kind of intangible essence of the person? Are you writing to their voice?
I think it's a deeper contemplation.
Okay.
About the full feeling and experience of being with that person in the music. It would be really hard to, I don't want to put anything in a box. I don't want it to be a cipher for something else. Marta is such a wonderful and mysterious player. I can't say that I fully understand any of these three that are in the band, and that's part of the magic of the mystery of music. So Marta's, as I mentioned, you know, originally from Poland, she doesn't play any Chopin, but there's this sort of sensibility that can be there. And sometimes I get this, this is funny, because if she ever hears this interview, she'd be like, I can't believe that's what you thought. That there's a feeling like she's really pushed against that background in her playing. And she's someone who will really push at the boundaries of a composition in a way that she's spent enough time in Holland now that sometimes it reminds me of Han Benninck or Misha Mengelberg, you know, that pushing back against any constraint or any compositional boundary. And I love that, but she also has a very thoughtful and pensive way of doing it. And so in writing Ruminants, I had this picture of her moving slowly through the music, ruminating, but at the same time creating chaos and really bringing herself to it, which she does beautifully in the performance. They are all concerti in a way, you know, each of the players is featured, but they were also written, you know, with the inspiration of the person. And it was one of the things I wanted to get at in this specific idea of freedoms, you know, different ways of attacking the idea of composed and improvised music in new ways that we hadn't done before. There's something interesting about the CD. Some of it was recorded on the concert in this town called Getxo, which is close to Bilbao, northern Spain. And then some of it was recorded the next day on the same stage with the same setup and no audience.
Yeah.
And my intention in producing the record was to make the whole record the following day on the stage with no audience, like a studio album. But we recorded both sets, the show and the following day. And the album is about half and half, as it turns out. And the sound was so close that you can't really tell. The only way to tell is when some of the tunes, there's a little bit of applause at the end. And those are obviously live.
Very enthusiastic applause. You know, like it seemed like it was a very receptive,
great place.
Warm and welcoming crowd. Yeah.
It's a great, I've been going to Getxo for a lot of years and I love the Basque country, but there's a funny story. I can't even remember how many years ago, but there was a year that Spain was in the World Cup and they were doing really well. It might've been the final. And I've always been a big fan of Spain, soccer, football. And I got a pair of Spain soccer shoes, they're distinctively red and orange. Mm-hmm. And because Spain was in the cup and we were going to play a bunch of gigs in Spain, I brought these shoes with me and I wore them on stage. And I came walking out on stage and the audience just erupted, just like everyone went crazy. I was like, what's going on? What happened? Joey was like, I think it's your shoes. And so ever since that time, whenever I go there, somebody reminds me, so you're still following the team? What about Donny Olbo?
you gotta make sure that you keep up on things. So you can,
whenever they're there, I keep up on it. It's great. They're great at tennis too, the Spaniards.
I want to talk about your observation of the scene that has been coming up. There's so many younger musicians, and I know that you've, partly because of the Festival of New Trumpet Music, but also just because of who you are, I know you've got your ear to the ground. And I wonder if you can offer sort of a temperature read or any thoughts about where things are at in terms of the language or the energy.
I do keep my ear to the ground, but I no longer feel like I'm hearing all there is to hear. Mm-hmm. There's so much more. As you can see from my background, I live a little bit outside the city now. There's so many great new venues that I would go out every night and hear players, and I can't get down there. I can't do it. I'm writing a book and I'm writing a show and I'm producing these new records and I just don't, and I'd still like to continue to be a trumpet player, which takes some hours every day. And so I would say I do listen a lot, and there's so much happening. I used to say 30 years ago, this is a golden age for the contemporary creative music. And I think it's probably double or triple now what it was then. We're having this conversation because there's a new album called Four Freedoms, and a lot of the conversation was around our country and what's happening. And these are wonderful things that's happening. And the Four Freedoms, it's hard for me not to reflect. Well, people say the Founding Fathers. I'm not crazy about that term. But if you think about the Founding Fathers in our music, it's Mary Lou Williams. It's Wayne Shorter, it's Dizzy Gillespie, it's Louis Armstrong, it's Wadada Leo Smith, all these spirits flying around. And just to be a part of that feels like American freedom in an aspirational way, in which we're all working to make this a better place. And there may be a lot of things happening in the government that are very disturbing, but we have to remember we're here for each other. We can't leave anybody behind. And we just continue to do our work in the fullest and most personal way that we can. And that is the spirit of our spirit mentors and parents.
Yeah. You know, towards the end of his speech, FDR identifies the rise of tyranny and the will of dictators. And he was obviously looking across the ocean when he said that. And he said, to that new order, we oppose the greater conception, the moral order. A good society is able to face schemes of world domination and foreign revolutions alike without fear. And as you're talking about what the music engenders and what the community around it and the way that musicians exist within the music, you know, the nature of that exchange and the shared ideals, I mean, to me, that is a nice stand-in for what FDR called the moral order. because it is just, it's positive, it is uplifting, it is, it's not purely self-regarding. And I think it shows the way, you know, it shows us what is possible.
Absolutely. Absolutely. It's teamwork. We didn't mention the song Sandhogs.
And, please.
Well, what you're saying reminds me so much of our new mayor in New York, Zoran Mamdani. What an inspiring figure. So Sandhogs is this word that I came across that refers to the people who built the subways and the tunnels across to New Jersey, across to Queens, that went down there in the dirt, dug those holes, and sometimes didn't come out until it was done. Like, they would live down there. So this was like these people who dedicated themselves to getting those jobs done. Public jobs that were, you could even say, probably begun around the time of Fiorello LaGuardia, the mayor that Mamdani models himself on.
Yeah.
And so there is this positive force.
Yeah.
That is there.
For the public good.
And that we can hope the pendulum will swing back towards things that make sense and help more people.
Yeah. Amen to that. Thank you again, Dave. This is, as always, it's really great to exchange ideas with you. And of course, the music is generative and very fun. I hope I have a chance to see this band sometime soon.
Great to talk to you, and thank you for having me on, and nice to see you in the studio there producing all these great podcasts. So thanks.
All right. Thanks, Dave.
Peace.
Interesting conversation, Nate, with Dave Douglas about four freedoms. I always think about that dichotomy of the freedom to and the freedom from. Those are very important to me.
Yeah. Yeah. And I like thinking and hearing Dave talk about how that translates to the ensemble dynamics. You know, like he's obviously a very thoughtful composer. And really, you know, somebody who cares about the voices of the people he works with. You know, how do I bring them in? How do I really create something that spotlights who they are, you know?
Yeah.
So yeah, I really enjoyed that too. And speaking of enjoyment, it's about that time.
To dig something.
This I dig. Here we go.
There is a wonderful recording that has come out early this year from New Orleans, the Colossus Brass Band. Do you know about this group?
I do not.
So this is largely led by a trumpeter, Mark Bro, who's been playing in New Orleans for many decades. And his uncle is Wendell Brunius, great trumpeter who plays with Preservation Hall. He's connected to a real lineage, Mark, and many of the members of this Colossus Brass Band are as well. Freddie Lonzo, great trombonist, and Wendell Brunius is on this. Kevin Lewis, just the trumpet section alone is pretty absurd. What I love about this record, Sing on Old Saw Records, which is a very new label that started with this recording. What I love about it is it reminds me very deeply about the sacred aspects of the New Orleans music tradition, because I love brass band music as much as the next person, and I love Rebirth and Dirty Dozen and all that stuff. But it's the old guard that I sort of have a soft spot for.
Mm-hmm.
And I love this because while some of the music is what you would expect a New Orleans brass band to play, there's a lot of new music that Mark wrote, the old style dirges, and they're beautiful. There's one in particular, When the Burden is Lifted. It just reminds me of seeing largely men back in the day dressed to the nines in the streets with their instruments. That old kind of romanticized view of New Orleans,
mm-hmm.
it still exists generationally through the musicians who are playing today. Saxophonist on the Colossus is Roderick Paulin. Doc Paulin was a huge influence.
Mm-hmm.
In music in Uptown New Orleans. Kirk Joseph on trombone. I mean, you know, there's like a connection to Frog Joseph. I mean, there's just so many different connections to, I hate to say it, but the real New Orleans music,
mm-hmm.
the stuff that needs to be protected in some ways, and also carried forward, which is what I love about Mark writing a lot of new music for this band that sounds like it was written 100 years ago.
Yeah.
And it's executed beautifully.
All right. It's in my queue.
All right.
That's a great recommendation. Thank you. I'm going to go a little more mainstream.
Let's go.
And tell me if I've recommended this on This I Dig before. I feel like I've only recommended it to you personally.
Okay.
But there's a show that probably everyone by now has heard of called The Pit. It is back.
Yeah.
For its second season. Its first season just won 2 Golden Globe Awards, one for best television drama and the other for best actor in a drama series for Noah Wyle. This show is just, you know, it is so satisfying. It just makes me think about craft, right? It's so satisfying to watch a TV show that just understands that it's television and kind of like plays by the rules of television, but also pushes against them in some useful ways. And then it's also immensely satisfying to watch a depiction of people who are really, really good at what they do, trying to figure out how to do it under duress. You know, and the duress comes in the form of like small problems that are screaming at you in the face. And it also comes in the form of systemic problems that you have to kind of solve for in a more holistic manner. You know,
I always tell my daughter, who is attending the University of Pittsburgh and her intention is to be pre-med.
Mm-hmm.
I always tell her that this show is going to ruin it because everybody's going to want to apply to the University of Pittsburgh's medical school, which is already a great medical school. I said, but this show is not doing you any favors. It's making Pittsburgh like cool.
She is well positioned to, you know, she's in the, what's the word? Like the jump seat, you know, but yeah, I mean, it's just a really good show. I've only seen, you know, as we're taping, I've only seen the first episode of the second season, but there's an understanding that a longer arc is at play. Like we know that something is going to go down, but moment to moment is just a really good watch.
It's also a really good record by Roy Hargrove to get back into jazz. Hey, you see what I did there?
Josh can always be trusted to bring it back to jazz.
There you go. 6 degrees. Or less. The Late Set is a production of WRTI and made possible by WRTI members. Enjoy this podcast? Leave us a rating on the podcast platform of your choice. Also, be sure to subscribe and follow us on social media.
Our show is hosted by me, Nate Chenin, with Josh Jackson, and the show is produced by Alex Arif.
Robbie Webb is our assistant production manager and mixed this episode. Our production assistants are Alexander Bolliker, Jacob Dodds, Delia Joyce, and Alana Beltran.
Our director of operations and production is Tyler McClure. Associate general manager for content and programming is Josh Jackson, and Bill Johnson is WRTI's general manager.
Stop by WRTI.org and check out everything else we're cooking up in Philly and beyond, and we'll see you soon.